A lonely vegetarian sweep you off your feet like a maid Marian having fun like a seminarian.
Hello and welcome to the Mount Kisco Public Library Podcast. This episode features Kristen Kishore, who will be telling us all about her latest novel, Bitter Blue.
Good morning, Kristen. It's Deirdre. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. So I'm here with Mary, and we also have some questions from my colleague Maria, who unfortunately can't join us today. But
I'm sorry to hear that.
But we want to thank you so much for talking to us again.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So we were thrilled with Bitter Blue. We thought it was such an interesting book and such an interesting adjunct to the other books that you've written in the series. I always like it when a third book does something unusual or different. Did you always have a plan for Bitter Blue in your mind?
No. Each of the books kind of surprised me. The desire to write each of the books surprised me. And I was partway through Fire before it ever struck me that I wanted to write Bitter Blue.
You had then at that point a desire for the characters to connect in a different way?
Yes. You know, when I first got the idea to write about Bitter Blue, I wasn't actually sure which characters were going to be involved in the story. I just realized, you know, this is a fascinating character, and her story is an enormous part of all of these other stories I've been telling, and it kind of felt like she was asking me to tell her story next.
And what I thought, and I think many, many people find it interesting, that Bitter Blue is a heroine who's perfectly ordinary in many ways.
Yes.
She's somebody without any superpowers. She's somebody with a lot of questions. And
yes,
she seems like a real teenager in that way.
Yes, I really enjoyed, I didn't realize how different it was going to feel, but I really enjoyed writing about a character who wasn't a superhero in any way. I felt I could relate to her a little more than I had ever been able to relate to Katza or Fire, and it was a real pleasure. I would love, of course she is ordinary, but she is also a queen. I would love at some point to write about a character who is both ordinary and not extraordinarily wealthy or powerful. So maybe that'll be a future challenge.
Right. You do have some characters like that in the book.
Yes, I do. I just am not writing from their perspective, but yeah,
right. Definitely.
Yeah.
Which leads me to one more question, which is, do you think that maybe another character in this world will form the center of a story? Or is
I don't
this...
know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's next. I know I'm not done. I'm still kind of letting the ideas formulate.
Oh, we very much hope you're not done. We're looking forward to the next book.
Thank you.
So I think maybe we will ask one or two of Maria's questions, and then Mary definitely has a couple for you.
Sure.
Actually, I thought that I might ask mine first because it's a sort of natural lead-in from that.
Okay.
I am fascinated and horrified by Lex. I think that he's the best villain ever, but I just can't believe that you managed to write his journals. In preparation for Bitter Blue's story or even for Fires, did you find it necessary to write this story from his point of view? And how did you ever manage to do that, if you did?
Well, I didn't write those journals until I actually got to that point in Bitter Blue. And I kind of had vague imaginings of what they were about, but as with a lot of other aspects of Bitter Blue, it wasn't until I was actually doing it that I realized, oh my God, this is awful.
Yeah.
And it was the hardest writing I have ever had to do. It was so depressing. And you know, maybe it took me 2 weeks to write something it takes you 5 minutes to read. And so it was a bad time. When I write, I'm not generally, at least with Bitter Blue, I wasn't sharing what I was writing about with my friends and people in my life because it's very private when I'm writing it. And so I didn't really have anyone I could talk to and say, this is what is going on. So I was just saying to a lot of friends, it's awful right now. In a couple years when you read this, I'll explain why. But I felt very alone with it. I would write a draft leave it for the day, find some way to get my mind off of it, come back the next day, reread it, and realize, you know what, it's not actually awful enough yet. I have to make it worse, and be practically in tears at the realization that I have to revisit this again. I am so, so happy to be done telling the story of Lek. People have occasionally asked me at events, would I ever consider writing a book from his viewpoint? And I shudder at the very thought. I think that would be very bad for my mental health.
Oh, I would think so. And Lek is terrifying because to me, somehow he's so believable. And yet, it's kind of, is it just that he got stuck at this very egotistical two-year-old phrase? Or what is wrong with him? I can't imagine how you came up with this villain.
You know, I don't really know what's wrong with him, except that he had way too much power, and he never stopped to think about other ways of using it. I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with him. I'd rather not think about it.
So I want to switch gears a little bit and ask a fascinating question from Maria. She wanted to know, if a character from another book could join the cast world of Bitter Blue, who would it be?
Oh, that's an interesting question. That's the kind of question that I'm just not going to be able to actually give an answer to, because it requires a sort of card catalog type of brain that I don't have. Like, if I'm asked a question like that, then I am immediately unable to think of any books.
Uh-huh. Oh.
I have the same problem when people ask me, you know, what books do I recommend? Suddenly I can't think of any books, including the one I'm currently reading. But I would be interested to hear readers express their thoughts about that, who they think would fit in this world.
Hmm.
I mean, any character I love from any genre of book, including, you know, contemporary realistic stuff, it would be fun to think, what if we threw this character into this world, what would happen? Do you have any thoughts, or did Maria have any thoughts about characters who should...
Gosh, I don't know. One of the things that I always think is it would be kind of fun to have a shootout between Voldemort, Charlie X from Star Trek, and Lek, because they all have similar mindsets, and I wonder who would win. But
I feel like there's some sort of online, Clash of the Villains or something like that that happens now and then, where people vote for who would win in certain matchups.
Well, I think that Charlie X and Lek would do in Voldemort really, really fast, but I don't know which of those two would then take the prize.
That makes me oddly proud.
Yeah, kill Voldemort. But anyway, Maria also asked, what are some of the books on your to-be-read pile?
Well, that I can answer simply because I happen to be right next to my to-be-read pile at this moment. I actually just started Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wine, which I've heard such good things about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've just started it and I'm already completely enjoying it. And let me see what else I have here. I have Breadcrumbs by
Anne Ursu. Yeah.
And I have Flora Secunda by Isabel Wilf. And then I'm rereading Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, which is a book that I just love. And I also have Little Big by John Crowley, which I know nothing about, but it was recommended to me by a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my...
Cool. That's an interesting mix of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, let's see. I mean, I have some other things, too, but this could go on forever. I mean, my TBR pile is hundreds of books. So,
yeah.
I'm sure you understand. I'm sure yours is similar.
Oh, totally. Totally. So, I did have another couple of questions, and one of mine, and maybe we should put a big spoiler alert in case people haven't read Bitter Blue, actually.
So. Oh, okay.
Spoiler. Okay. I was really fascinated by the codes.
Oh, okay.
And particularly the embroidery code.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about some of the slave quilts and other sort of historical precedents for women's art and work that bears a message. And I don't know if you know, for instance, Peace of Justice by Jill Patton Walsh.
That is actually one of my favorite books.
Cool. Cool. Where
again, this piece of women's work bears a very important message. And I wondered, what were some of your inspirations for inventing this code?
Well, you know, it's hilarious you brought that up, because it had actually never even occurred to me until this moment that that book might have influenced my embroidery code. But now that you've brought it up, I mean, it seems pretty obvious that it did. I mean, that's a book that I am always trying to push on my sisters to read. And so, I love
it's
that.
It's awesome. Yeah.
It's such a great book. Mm-hmm. Other influences, that's really hard to answer. I'm really not sure. I mean, I learned to embroider myself growing up. My own mother embroidered, and I have pillowcases and things in my own home that are her beautiful work. It's just something I grew up with. And it just kind of clicked that that is something Ashen would be doing, and it would be cheerful. And I kind of, once I figured it out, loved the juxtaposition between Bitter Blue hates the embroidery because she thinks it's this lie of happiness, but actually Ashen is actually lying. Ashen is in control of that lie. Uh-huh. It isn't a lie she's being forced to create because she doesn't know what's going on. It's a conscious lie, and I just liked giving Ashen that little bit of power because she has so little power.
Right, and she has enormous strength of character, which is shown by that, and it's wonderful. And the other thing I was thinking is that there's such a tradition all over the world of narrative in embroidery and weaving and other forms of needlework. And you have the juxtaposition. Like, as we know, in certain cultures, it's forbidden to actually depict living creatures. And in others, it's definitely something that you do. But in both cases, there's symbolism and narrative and what's created through cloth. And I thought it was really, really interesting how you did that here.
Well, thank you.
So, leaping on to something else, how did you come up with the names for the characters?
The names for the character. It really differs name to name. Mm-hmm. Some of them just felt right, like Teddy really seemed like a teddy to me, whereas Saf, it had to do with the color of his eyes, which had to do with where I was living when I started writing. When I started writing Bitter Blue, I was living in Jacksonville, Florida, and Jacksonville is on the river. There are these beautiful sunsets every evening, and I would walk, look at the sky and kind of imagine a character with eyes the color of that sky.
Wow.
I'm trying to think some of the other names.
Well, of course, all the Leonids have the color names.
Right, yes.
And
have the
bitter
color
blue,
name.
Like, what is a bitter shade of blue? You know, I always
thought
her name was really interesting.
And people have asked me about her name, and I just don't remember why I came up with it. It just felt so right when I did come up with it, so I guess I immediately then forgot where it came from because it didn't really matter to me. But and then the advisors. So actually, my advisors, one of them, there's a character named Theo in the calendar papers, which is by, is that a Cynthia Voigt book? The calendar papers? Anyway, there's a character who just kind of caught my eye on rereading. I'm actually walking to my bookshelf to see if I'm right about that. And then a couple of my other advisors, Cynthia Voigt wrote the calendar papers. And then a couple of my other advisors actually came from road signs around the Philadelphia area, which is where my parents live. So there's Darby. And then Runnymede comes from Runnymede. And I actually, I had another advisor named after another road sign, and then I just decided, no, this is getting ridiculous because people from that area are going to be like, okay, we have, here's Darby, I guess the next one's going to be named Upper Darby, you know, like, I was afraid they were becoming too familiar.
Although it's very cool, Thiel is, to me, a particularly interesting, I loved him.
I did too.
He made me so sad, and I loved him.
Oh, yes.
And my mind works in a very associative way, and I was thinking about the Tula, you know?
The who?
You spell it T-H-U-L-E, and it's the extreme north. And there's okay. There's a famous song about a king who lived there. But anyway, it's neither here nor there. But I was thinking, he reminds me of winter, of loss, of cold, you know, just by the name.
Yeah,
and I thought
okay.
that was so cool. I mean, not to be making bad puns. But
why not? Bad puns are good.
Well, that's a really nice connection. Actually, one of the things I've loved since I started publishing books is connections that I never intended or realized or were accidental.
Mm-hmm.
There's only so much the author has to do with the final result, and I love that people can make connections like that perhaps I never intended.
Right.
Speaking of connections, if I may jump in.
Of course.
I love Thiel too, and I also love death. I was thinking, was he a tribute to Lord Peter?
Yes, Thief is definitely named after. I went through so many names with him, and they just weren't working. And then I was probably rereading a Lord Peter book, and suddenly decided, you know what? This is a little weird, but I'm going to try naming him Thief. And I had a conversation with my editor about it, and she was fine with it. And he also just became one of my most fun characters
to
write.
Oh, he's lovely. Yeah.
But and I felt like the name suited him.
Yes, it does. But what I was going to say is that, in a way, I see him and Thiel as Bitter Blue's saviors, as imperfect as they both are, Thiel especially. And it seems interesting to me that in this entire series you have a lot of imperfect or flawed fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the people who kind of take Lex's place.
That's really nice.
A sort of better father, if you know what. Am I making any sense here?
Yes, you are, and it's really nice to hear. When you pointed out, it's pretty obvious, but I kind of hadn't thought of. I had been so focused on, oh my goodness, I keep writing these horrible fathers over and over again. I have the most kind, gentle father in the world, and I've been worrying that people think I'm a terrible father myself, whereas my father is seriously the kindest, gentlest man I have ever met. But there are all these other father figures that I'm creating. I'm not really responding in any interesting way, but you've pointed out something that I appreciate. It's nice to think about.
I ended up being horrified by the advisors, but feeling so, so sorry for them.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how much of the book as a whole is based on reality.
I was wondering that too.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I feel like with all the Graces, there are real-life equivalents, and I think there are rulers in the world who can do what Lek can do in some sense, and certainly there have been regimes like Lex, and I, of course, was thinking about some of that as I wrote, no question. I really felt like I was telling a true story. Type of story, and I was doing research into two different things. One, I was doing research into post-traumatic stress to figure out how the people who lived through his reign would be coping now. And I also did research into cults, mm-hmm. learning a bit about cult leaders and how they manage to control people with words. Managed to hook into some really not logical part of mm-hmm. human beings with charisma and words. So yeah, I definitely feel like it was a book based on real history.
Speaking of that, did you also read or study about the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commissions?
I did in a very brief sense, but I was actually thinking more about Rwanda just because I have a friend who's an anthropologist whose work is there, and they, I think, have had a similar truth-telling sort of project there. And I don't want to say any more just because I honestly, I don't have a memory for facts or history, and I'm afraid that I will say something that is not actually true. But when I was in the process of planning the book, I was looking into that.
Mm. I'm just sitting here thinking, you know.
Yeah.
It's given us so much to think about. Romance, I guess maybe that was one question that I was wondering about, because you know how people are always shipping. We've known some people who were very upset at certain books because the wrong people got together.
Oh.
But I thought it was really interesting, the romance in this book, and how it gives Bitter Blue a type of freedom she hasn't known before.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe for that reason is more powerful for her, however the reader might feel about it.
Right.
And I wonder how you decided who she should fall in love with, or did you decide that consciously?
There was probably a time early in the beginning when, there's always a time when I have the plan has come to me, but then I feel like I should really be testing this out. So I'm sure I thought, oh, should it be Teddy? Oh, is this right? Do I need to be creating other characters? But I kind of always felt like Seth is going to be the one, just because he's so different from her, and he's a little bit sparkly in the way Poe is sparkly, and I think Bitter Blue has a little bit of a cousin crush on Poe.
Uh-huh, yes.
And there are moments when I try to create the connection between the ways Saf reminds Bitter Blue of both Poe and Katza, because I also think Bitter Blue has a bit of a crush on Katza.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of felt to me like this character who embodied both of two of the people Bitter Blue just loves most dearly in the whole world. And, of course, he's his own person as well, and those aspects of him she found attractive too. So I think it was, you know, conscious and unconscious, and mostly it just felt right. Like, when I'm trying to figure out the story, I'm just trying to feel for, well, what would happen, you know? What is this story, rather than trying to direct it? I wasn't completely sure where it was going to go with them, but I had a feeling it was going to go the way it did end up going.
Hmm, cool. The other thing, of course, is that there end up being more and more layers to the society. The more Bitter Blue explores, the more she sees, because the more there is there to see. And there is that very interesting kind of fringe, a criminal element that's going
yeah.
on, as well as the layers and layers that she discovers around her.
Right, yes.
And I wondered, well, I guess that you're left with a lot of questions about Fox and her society.
Oh, yeah.
Because
right.
You could almost see her as a Robin Hood figure in a sense.
Right.
Almost as a positive.
Huh, that's interesting. Can I see her as a positive?
Is it possible? You know? Because she's so ambiguous to me, and I thought that was really interesting.
That's true. You could certainly get a lot into her more and learn a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a book about people lying about who they are.
Right. Yeah, or not quite knowing even who they are.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah, that's true.
And discovering in the end. And okay, how do you pronounce the character who begins with H?
Hava,
thank you.
You're welcome.
She was one of my faves, and of course you find out something really key about her later on,
yes.
which I don't want to spoil for people who haven't read the book. But a thing I loved that you did about her is that she is always trying to make herself appear more beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
And where she really finds love is when she doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really nice.
So
yeah.
Thank you for that. I thought that was so awesome.
Oh, thank you. That's, again, not something I had consciously thought through before, so it's a beautiful interpretation to hear, so I really appreciate that. Yeah, she was really an interesting character who evolved a lot between the drafts.
Mm-hmm.
The person she is in the final draft is not the same as the person she was in the beginning. Her grace is the same, but
right.
It took me a few drafts to make all the connections with her and realize, who is this person who's wandering around with this extremely bizarre ability?
Mm-hmm.
She was kind of unconnected in the earlier drafts and more of a plot tool. And some characters are more difficult to get to know than others, and it really is fairly straightforward which ones are. The ones who are difficult to get to know in the book are also difficult for me to get to know. So Theo is another example. These are the characters who it took all the drafts. Saf actually was difficult too. It took all the drafts for me to start to feel like, okay, this person is finally willing to show themselves to me a little bit. Whereas Poe, for example, I have never had a hard time knowing him because he's so talkative.
Right.
He's so, I mean, he has his one big secret, but aside from that, he's a very open person. And Gideon in this draft as well was a lot more open than he's been in the past, and so I found him easier to write. I've kind of branched off into answering questions you haven't asked, but
that is great.
but Hava, I would like to think about her more. And a few people have said to me that they really were fascinated by her. So I'm even when I'm done writing a book, there are still a handful of characters that I don't feel like I quite know yet. She's one of them.
That is great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We do know from your blog and other things that you study trapeze, flying trapeze, right? And
yes.
You have so many airs above the ground in this book. Did you want to write a book that had a lot of, like, stuff high up and acrobatics?
That's funny. True. You know, the first thing I want to say is just for the sake of being honest, I actually have not been doing the trapeze for about a year now. I stopped for various reasons, so that's more of a habit of my past at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a little bit helpful. I mean, I knew before I ever started doing the trapeze that there were going to be so many airs above the ground moments in the book, and I also knew that Bitter Blue had a fear of heights. So it was helpful for me because I do not have a fear of heights. I kind of love heights. But when you're up there about to do something terrifying, you start to feel that fear. So that was helpful for me to kind of, have a sense of what that was like. I had, maybe what I'm saying is I had to push myself to kind of an extreme to feel it. But then once I felt it, it helped me with Bitter Blue. So,
right.
So it did have its advantages for writing for me.
Wow, that's great to know. And I guess we can be happy you're not going to be doing anything dangerous in future.
I know my mother is happy.
Another question?
Well, actually, I have many, but I think that I probably won't ask them now. because, yeah, some of the questions would be spoilerish, and some of them, I think, are questions you're meant to be left with. For example, I'm still grieving about Theo. And I think, as Deirdre said, the advisors are horrifying, but at the same time, are there things that are unforgivable? And what happens when people really don't even know what they're doing? It's
how
can you blame them? And yet, they are, in a way, made scapegoats. But at the same time, how can they not be?
Well, and when you say, you're still grieving Theo, I just get this rush of sadness myself. I remember so distinctly every single time in revisions I would return to the page where the bad thing happens with Theo, which is stupid. I should just say it because it's already so spoilery, but before Bitter Blue, I never cried while writing my own books.
Mm-hmm.
And this book changed that. I found that my hand would be heavy turning the page to that page because I just didn't want it to happen every time.
Uh-huh.
And I would have to be looking at it with a critical eye and not thinking about what was happening and changing the wording here and there because maybe I was repeating a word too many times. And, and it just really is sad.
Yeah, it's sad. And I think you're meant to be, and that's not bad.
And I just had my one final question, which I always ask, and that is, what would you advise a young person, or maybe a person of any age, who wanted to be creative the way you are? What would you tell them?
I would tell them a couple things. One thing is, really listen to your instincts and your heart rather than to the world outside you when it comes to what it is you want to do and what's right and what you should be doing. It's a really valuable thing to be in touch with your own feelings when you're trying to be creative. And another thing I would say is, if you do have self-doubt, if you have voices that are telling you you're wasting your time or you're not actually any good at your art or whatever, that's really just kind of part of being an artist. Those voices, they don't go away. They're not there because they're right. They're there because you can't do something creative without self-doubt. It's part of the process. And what you just really need to do is not listen, you know, not believe them. Let them say what they need to say. Sometimes I imagine, a chair sitting next to me, and I sit this little depressing guy down, and he sits there, and he says all these kind of mean things to me, and every once in a while I kind of, give him a pat on the head and be like, you're so sad, you're so pathetic, nothing is ever happy for you. Maybe I pretend to give him a hug or whatever, but I don't let him tell me what to do or make my decisions for that day. So I guess my point is, just keep on going and don't believe that self-doubt, and don't take it for more than it is. It's just a part of the process.
Gee, that's wonderful. Thank you. That's
so
encouraging.
Oh, good. And
thank you so much.
Thank you. It's really nice to talk to you guys again.
Oh, it's great talking to you.
Yes. I'm so glad I could be here this morning. Thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
We have many other people we'd like to thank as well. First, many thanks to the Iliad for our opening song and Cursor Minor for our closing song. The text of Der König in Thule was written by Goethe, whose character Gretchen sings it in Faust. It has been set to music many times. This arrangement, based on a melody by Karl Friedrich Zelter, is written and performed by Sebastian Jacobi. The beautiful pictures gracing chapters 2, 5, 6, 8, 9, 11, and 13 are details from Ian Schoenherr's gorgeous illustrations of the book. The image for chapter 7 is a detail from a 1930 Icelandic coin depicting the King of Thule. Cover images 1, 4, and 10 are from Dial Books, Hyperion Books, and Carlsen Verlag. The photo of Kristen on the flying trapeze is by Molly and taken from her blog, and the portrait illustrating the episode is by Leslie Feigley. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. If you have any questions for us, you can contact us at the library. And as you know, if you want to get any copies of Kristen's book or any other books, there's one wonderful place you can go.
Kids, there's a really cool place you can be. It's a lot of fun, yeah, you will see. You can learn a lot about the world that we living in, the public library. The library, the library. It's a place where books are free. The library, the library. It's a lot better than watching TV. Sections about almost everything. You'll always find something you're interested in. Plate tectonics or embroidery. Michael Portillo or the banyan tree. The library. The library. It's a place where books are free.